big news. Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here. Right now, get up to 80% off everything you need for the season ahead. Save on kitchen and dining, bedroom furniture and mattresses, seasonal decor, and way more. All at Wayfair. These are Wayfair's best deals of the year. From seasonal finds to favorites you'll use all year long. Plus, enjoy fast and free shipping with delivery in time for the holidays. Save up to 80% off during Wayfair's Black Friday sale. Now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Science is just an inherently optimistic endeavor. So there's always something to be excited about. There's always something to be hopeful about.
So I was wondering how your team curates NatureNeuro and their issues to capture the breadth of this field.
Sometimes when we read a paper, it's sort of like you're reading the paper beyond the paper, and you have to think about how does this fit in with everything else that's been done, and also where could this go?
Welcome back to STEMcast in our special series, Beyond the Lab, where we speak about the incredible opportunities that come alongside a research career. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Sherry Wiseman, chief editor of Nature Neuroscience, a role she took on in 2017 after completing her postdoctoral research at Harvard Medical School and Tufts University. Sherry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. Mm-hmm.
So many of our listeners are students. And so before we jump into what you're doing now, I wanted to turn back the clock a bit and see what you were like as a student and what initially drew you to neuroscience and research as a whole.
So I was always very interested in, you know, biology and also in psychology. So understanding sort of, you know, how the mind works and thoughts and emotions. And I have several family members who have mental illness and had been on psychiatric medication. And so that was something that kind of really jump-started my thinking about how do we understand, you know, the brain as both, you know, generating these sort of psychological experiences or concepts, you know, emotions and thoughts and motivations, and also as something biological that we can modulate with, you know, medicines. And so that really propelled my interest in neuroscience as the kind of intersection of these two ideas. And I was very lucky when I went to college to get involved in working in a research lab right after my first year. So the summer right after my first year, and I was just completely smitten. I was just like, I was pretty sure starting college that I wanted to be a neuroscientist. And then once I started working in the lab, I was just like, oh, this is for me. I love this. So I was in a mostly behavioral neuroscience lab. And it was so cool for me to see, you know, to be able to do the kinds of behavioral experiments with rats that I had like sort of read about in textbooks, like to be able to do, you know, operant conditioning and fear conditioning and to study learning and memory, and mostly learning and memory and addiction, and sort of thinking about addiction as a disease of learning and memory. And also I just loved, you know, the environment of being in the lab and just how fun it is, you know, how it's just kind of everyone's hanging out all day and chatting and exploring. And I really loved it.
And the exchange of ideas. So I'm in a lab now as well. And so the curiosity that a lab kind of fosters, because you get to talk to so many people and oftentimes they're working on different things, is really incredible. So
yeah, I think this is maybe an underrated part of the experience of doing science. I think especially post-COVID, now that people are inclined to work from home more, which I, you know, I completely understand, but so much of what's great about being in a lab and doing science is just the kind of hanging out. It's just the sort of like in between times, or, you know, the coffee breaks, and just kind of like talking about papers that you've seen, or, you know, floating ideas for experiments, or talking to other people about, you know, how to optimize this or that. Or, you know, it's just, you just build these bonds with people, I think, partly from spending so much time together and partly from going through so much frustration together when things don't work. But I think you end up being really, really close with the people that you work in a lab with, and really building a lot of trust.
You're absolutely right. I know recently I was working on a manuscript, and a lot of that trust translated into me being comfortable enough for asking for advice on this manuscript to
Exactly.
help, right? Especially because it's something so personal and you've worked on for so long. And I know then that you actually explored this editing and manuscript writing process. I was wondering if there was a moment when you realized that this was something that interests you, like what stopped that?
So I always thought that I was going to be a PI, and that was I was very set on that, and I felt very sort of motivated by that. And it wasn't until maybe the end of grad school when I was a little bit burnt out, or a little, a little kind of less enthusiastic, let's say, that I even started thinking about other possibilities. But I thought, oh, maybe I'll just, I'll go do a postdoc, I'll try something new, and maybe that'll kind of rekindle my excitement for being in the lab. But I had these little kernels of thinking about it, and some of the things that drew me in that direction were, I was always very interested in the field more broadly than just in my own projects. And I was someone, I was very lucky to be at a place where there were lots of talks. But I would go sometimes to three talks a day. I would go to every talk I could get my hands on, and even, everything in neuroscience, but even outside of neuroscience, I would go to like cell biology talks and genetics and whatever. And I was very lucky also that my PI, my grad school mentor, Angus Nairn, is similarly inclined and would see me at all these talks and never never came up to me and said, "What are you doing here? Get back in the lab." He'd always say, "Hey, what'd you think of that talk?" I was always reading the literature broadly too. So I was subscribed probably to like 50 or more journal table of contents, and I was just always really excited to see everything that was coming out. And my PI was a member of this thing that at the time was called Faculty of 1,000, and it's sort of changed names, but it was essentially a blog where scientists would recommend papers and just write a little sort of blurb about, summarizing them and explaining why they thought they were interesting, similar to the sort of research highlights that I write now, actually. And he brought me in and had me doing that with him. And actually, we did it together even when I was a postdoc. We did it for years and years. It was nice for me to be able to sort of choose papers and think about what makes a strong paper and what makes a weak paper. And okay, so how did I get the idea to be an editor? Well, so I had some bad luck as a postdoc. Slowly realized that I was not actually that great at doing bench work, and I wasn't that great at getting experiments to work. And that's when I started more seriously thinking about alternative careers. And having moved into the editorial career, I've been struck that it actually has a lot of features that overlap with what was appealing to me about being a PI. So, I'm doing a lot of reading and writing and thinking about science. I get to travel and go to conferences. I get to give talks. And now that I'm the chief editor, I get to manage people. So there's really a lot of overlapping skills. So I find the job very satisfying for that reason. But at the same time, my career success isn't so dependent on getting experiments to work, which was never, never my strong suit.
I mean, you touched on this already a bit, but when you came into Nature Neuro as chief editor in 2021, but you came in 2017, if I'm not mistaken.
So I started in 2017, and then I became the chief in 2021.
You talked about this a bit before, but I was wondering what excites you the most about it, maybe now, but also then, perhaps it changed. Something that perhaps not a lot of people might know about the role that makes it as fulfilling as you say.
So I would say there's a few things that I find the most fulfilling. One is that I'm really fortunate to work with people who I genuinely like and care about. And people, my editorial colleagues are so smart and so insightful and so passionate about what we do. That's a real pleasure. And we just, I really enjoy. I don't get to see my team in person very much because we mostly work remotely, and a lot of the members of my team are in London, and I have one also in Berlin. But we're chatting throughout the day, and it's actually sort of like being in a lab together. There's a lot of like sort of joking and camaraderie, and it's really lovely. For me, also, I really love the sort of external facing part of the job, which I get to do more of now that I'm chief. I really love traveling to conferences and meeting scientists. And I love being able to kind of shepherd a paper through the editorial and the peer review process and really, help a paper develop and become stronger and help a PI, especially a new PI, get their work out there. And also, when you go to conferences, you get to hear all kinds of exciting new ideas and see a lot of exciting new science. And that's, really stimulating. Yeah, I'm really, really fortunate to get to work with a lot of great people.
Honestly, what you're saying resonates with me personally a lot. I'm also the type of person who goes to a bunch of different seminars, listens across a broad range of fields, and to be able to have such a team that shares those interests really is incredible.
Yeah, it's really fun. I should say also, so I described what's exciting for me about the job as a sort of a more extroverted person, but it's actually a really good job if you're a more introverted person too, because day to day, most of what we're doing is sitting quietly at a computer and reading. And so, if you do like that kind of more focused kind of quiet work, it's also a really good job for that as well.
I guess moving a bit away from the responsibilities of the job and more towards the actual journal itself, so Nature and Earth Science. This might be more of a funky question, but I was wondering what you find that is kind of unique about Nature Neuro, that is something that you would point out to someone who perhaps isn't as familiar with the journal.
Well, I want to publish the best neuroscience journal in the world. And I personally think that we do. No disrespect to other journals or other colleagues, but I think that we're really, really fortunate to be able to publish some of the most exciting, impactful, innovative, creative content that there is in neuroscience. Our journal is highly selective. And I think that kind of selectivity, or sometimes we talk about the curation that the editors on our team do, is actually a huge service to the field. I think it lets readers know that if something is coming out in our journal, there must be something really special about it. Either this is, the biggest, the best, the most innovative, the biggest advance, the coolest new technology, something like that.
It's great to see these kinds of things. And you did mention, oh, yes.
Oh, wait, I should mention a few other things about the journal that I think are really special. So one is also we are really, really committed to open science, and we've had a few notable moves in that direction, just even over the time that I've been an editor. So offering an open access publishing option, we have now a lot more requirements for sort of data accessibility and code accessibility. And yeah, I was going to say open science and rigor and reproducibility, but I think to me those things are linked, because the more transparent and open we are about our science, that I think that the more that we promote rigor and reproducibility.
Absolutely. So, open science, the quality of what you guys actually publish. So, these are all things people can look for. But there's one word that you actually said that I really hung on to, which is curation, especially in the field of neuroscience. So, you said your team receives not only an incredible volume, but also an incredible range in terms of the topics. And that comes with the field of neuroscience, right?
It's a huge field. It's a very broad field. Yes.
Exactly. So, I was wondering how your team curates Nature Neuro and their issues to capture the breadth of this field.
Ah, so that's a good question. So the initial kind of curation process would be the decision by the handling editor of whether or not to send the paper out for peer review. And it's about 80%. Actually, we've had a bump in submission, so now it's even a little bit lower. It's maybe closer to 85% of the papers that get submitted that are not sent out for peer review. And typically that's because either the paper doesn't provide a sufficient conceptual advance, or because the paper won't be of broad enough interest to work for our journal. So we want to publish papers that appeal to a pretty broad swath of the field rather than just the sort of specialists in one specific kind of immediate area. And in terms of the decision making around that, I mean, that really is something that editors develop over time. It's just sort of understanding the field and having a sort of a broad a broader view of the field as opposed to the kind of more specific kind of specialized knowledge that you would have, as a graduate student or a postdoc working in one specific area. So, the editors are on our team, they do specialize to some extent, but they're handling much, much broader areas of neuroscience. So, for example, I'm handling kind of anything cellular and molecular, human genetics. We have, an editor who handles anything human cognitive neuroscience, that kind of thing. So it's pretty broad chunks of the field. And I think a real value in having full-time professional editors. So there are other journals like society journals, like the Journal of Neuroscience or like eLife, say, where the editors are PIs. And so they're also running their own research labs and they sort of work as editors on the side. And I think being able to just be an editor really does kind of provide you with the sort of breadth of knowledge and a certain perspective and a certain discernment that's really valuable. And I think we're very fortunate that people submit excellent papers to us, but I think the thing that allows our journal to be consistently excellent is having this team of in-house editors who have such great taste and who are able to spot, not only spot the papers that are already really strong, but spot the papers that maybe have a kernel of something interesting that could develop through the peer review process, or maybe they need to add this or that, but they can kind of see, they have this sort of aesthetic sense of what could make this a strong paper, what's interesting. And I think that that's really the secret to the strength of the journal.
I mean, we talk a lot about the creative process in science, so for a researcher, but I guess not a lot of people see that the creative process in science communication, the publication after the research is done.
That's a really good point. And that's something that I worried about in terms of transitioning into this career is, am I going to be able to be creative? Because that's something that I really value. And that's definitely part of doing scientific research. There's so much creativity. And I think non-scientists maybe don't recognize that or maybe don't think about it that way, that they think it's just about kind of observing things, but there's so much creativity, right, that goes into, designing an experiment and or having an interesting idea of something to study. And so I was worried that I might lose that. I was worried that that being an editor is just kind of pushing papers around, and you don't have any ideas or you don't, add anything. And that, that hasn't been my experience. So I would say, we do have the opportunity to be creative in terms of, like I said, sort of spotting how a paper can grow. So understanding, sort of, sometimes when we read a paper, it's sort of like you're reading the paper beyond the paper, and you have to think about sort of the context of the field. How does this fit in with everything else that's been done? And also where could this go? So what do we want them to add? But what is this core idea that's sort of new that we think is exciting? And sometimes we even get into the details a little bit. If we're working with authors closely on a revision, we might say, like, oh, well, what if you tried using this technique? Or is there a way you could do something, this way or that way? But then we also have the opportunity to be creative in terms of commissioning content. So our reviews and perspectives, for example, are typically commissioned, which means that we have the idea for a topic that we want to cover, and we think about, how do we want that to be structured and who would be the right author for that? What kind of voices do we want to bring in? And, similarly for the Q&As and for other special projects that we do, like, special focus issues or something, it's growing out of an idea that we have for something that we want to feature.
I mean, just thinking about not only the creative process of looking at a paper beyond the paper, so seeing how it fits into different subsets of neuroscience as a whole, I imagine there might be also maybe a bit of weight in thinking about how what you guys decide on going forward with kind of shapes the field, right? It's what everybody sees. And so, in a way, it kind of becomes what is.
So it is a tremendous privilege to be able to shape the field in that way, and to be able to, to shape the field in terms of what content we're highlighting, but also in terms of our sort of editorial standards. So to be able to say, no, you really do need, some kind of validation, or you really do need a, more mechanistic detail. You need this kind of experiment or that kind of experiment. And that does kind of bring the field along. Or some of the, mandates that we've put in place in terms of methods reporting and data availability, that really also does kind of bring the field along in terms of what's expected. So, it's a responsibility that we take seriously. We're very, very fortunate that people pay a lot of attention to the papers that we publish. And it's great for our authors, but it does mean that a certain amount of scrutiny comes with it also. But mostly it's exciting. Pick out papers that we think are exciting and have them go out into the world and see. And it's really, really fun for me to see how they're resonating with the community. So I love, I run our social media accounts, and so I love seeing, when a paper that I tweeted about is getting a lot of likes or getting a lot of discussion. My favorite thing is when a paper that we publish gets a lot of press coverage, which does happen sometimes. So like we had a paper earlier this year from Eddie Chang's group at UCSF about essentially reading out speech from a paralyzed person's brain and having the sort of words come out in real time as they're thinking of them. That got a lot of press coverage.
And this goes back to the you guys setting, not setting, but influencing the field, both in terms of the content, but also the standards. So, for example, you said open science is something you guys are really, really pushing for or very proud of. And so, this is the type of standard that you guys have, I guess, the privilege of promoting. But before I dive into open science as a whole, because it's a very big topic, wanted to just touch on one last more quote unquote scientific bit in terms of the neuroscience research that you guys help shape. As chief editor, you have this bird's eye view on what's going on, and you mentioned this a lot before when you said paper beyond the paper and looking at where it can go. I was wondering if you've seen research trends or shifts that have intrigued you throughout, I guess.
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at cinfin.com.
Years is a long time to remember all of this, but or any that you've seen now that, your perspective can
Oh,
really.
interesting. Yeah, I mean, that's, that is one of the interesting and kind of fun things about being in science. Once you've been in science for a little while, it is really interesting to see trends kind of come and go. And we always want to be, not that we're sort of ruled by trends, but we do want to be publishing the papers that we know that our readers are the most interested in and the most excited about. And also, we want to be publishing papers that have the biggest kind of conceptual advance. And that sort of means that we need to be focusing more on areas where we don't know as much, as opposed to areas that are more mature where we kind of already know a lot of details. It's harder to have a big advance. So there's no field that's we're closed to, within neuroscience, but it's just certain fields, it's a little harder to have a big advance because we already know a lot. So, something like I always pick on axon guidance for some reason, right? We know a lot about mechanisms of axon guidance, so it's a little harder to have a big advance there. So what are some trends that I've seen kind of come and go, even since I've been working at the journal? Or even like, since I've been in neuroscience to some extent, right? Like, so I would say when I started doing neuroscience research when I was an undergrad, like some of the hot things were like AMPA receptor trafficking and like mechanisms of LTP, long-term potentiation. You may, as a neuroscience undergrad, have not even heard of long-term potentiation, but it used to be a really, really hot, really big field. Mechanisms of like histone modification were really big, or sort of these epigenetic mechanisms, right, of sort of like long-term memory storage, that kind of thing. Those were kind of big areas, when I first started. Since I've been at the journal, it's so interesting. You see certain things kind of You see certain trends kind of rise and fall, or you see certain things that seem like it's going to be the kind of next hot topic in neuroscience, and then it never quite takes off. I mean, I would say, my time at the journal, I started in 2017, has really coincided with the rise of single-cell genomics. So we were just starting to publish those papers when I started. And for a while, you could look at like the top 10 cited papers that we published in any given year. And there were a few years where maybe 7 out of 10 of those papers would be single-cell sequencing papers. Thankfully now, if you look at the top 10, it's a little more diverse, but we had a few years of like a lot of single-cell sequencing. And organoid technology kind of started up around that same time as single-cell sequencing. We've published a few papers. Haven't published a ton of organoid papers, but that's, maybe another kind of trend that's come up. I mean, neuroimmunology, I think, has really taken the field by storm. And that's a trend that was starting around the time that I started, and related to that, but also thinking a lot more about glia, and especially thinking about sort of the diversity of glia. Our journal publishes a ton on astrocytes and microglia and oligodendrocytes, and we also publish quite a bit on neurovasculature. So all of these things that honestly, when I was an undergrad studying neuroscience, I really, really, really was only thinking about neurons, and I was thinking a lot about like synapses and synapse, synaptic plasticity and synapse formation and all this stuff about like sort of synaptic cell biology. And if you look at an issue of Nature Neuroscience now, we might not even have a single paper on synapses in an issue, but we probably will have a few papers on glia, right? So those are some interesting trends. I'm talking more about the cellular molecular side of things just because that's where I tend to focus. But you could say similar things for, some other kind of trendy topics would be maybe like psychedelics or AI.
There's a lot of comparisons between artificial neural networks and different brain, different is a lot of.
So those are all kind of hot areas. I guess also, when I started, we were still publishing a ton of, optogenetics
Yes.
papers. So, our journal actually published, the original
Like that.
optogenetic paper from Carl Dicerlath and Ed Boyden in, I think it came out in 2005, I want to say. So by the time I started, it had already been 10 years of optogenetics, but we still were publishing a ton of kind of circuit cracking papers, and our bar for those papers editorially has just gotten higher and higher and higher in terms of not just, activating this or that region, but you need to have the inputs, the outputs. You need to show that the circuit is active during a certain behavior. You need to activate it. You need to inhibit it. That kind of thing. So that's sort of the, and then the bar for, excuse me, for novelty for a circuit paper is also pretty high at this point. So, we do still publish some of those papers, but at the time that I started, we were publishing a lot of circuits and optogenetics.
You'd be happy to know that we do still learn our good old LTPs, basic neural plasticity mechanisms that happen on a neuronal level. But you're absolutely right in that a lot of our other courses touch on things that seem a bit more, what's the word? As in, there's been paradigm shifts, like Kuhnian paradigm shifts, right? People who listen to this podcast know that I always encourage a bit of philosophy of science. So, Thomas Kuhn, for those listening, can take a look at him. But the field of neuroscience has just become so interdisciplinary, and I think there's been key paradigm shifts, and some that you have mentioned, some perhaps were trends, but others I really do see as paradigm shifts. I don't know if you agree with that. There's certain moments where.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There are certain things that are trends that sort of move slowly, and then there's certain papers that are just sort of these watershed papers that really change the field or maybe start a whole new field. Yeah. That's always really exciting to be part of.
Do you see any trends that you think are rising to the surface? I know in the current June issue, there's a couple of really fun papers in there. Some
Oh, what
articles.
did you like in the now I need to come.
Well, okay. So I'm more on the computational side, and I really enjoy, like, the hippocampus is my favorite brain structure. And so I believe it was in the June issue, but hippocampal codes for experience relative to reward.
Oh, yeah.
And you're right, there's a couple articles or reviews, I think, on glial dynamics that were really interesting to
Yeah.
read. But it's really accessible in the way that there are research articles, news, and views alongside your good old articles for people trying
You
to.
know what? I think that's actually a really good thing to touch on, especially since this podcast is geared more towards people just starting out in neuroscience. So it's a really good tip when you're getting ready to read a paper. If you see that it has what we call a news and views associated with it, or sometimes we publish what's called a research briefing, which is similar to a news and so let me step back. A news and views is a short article that includes a summary. It gives some context for the paper and lets you sort of understand the rationale for it. It gives a summary of what was found, and then there's usually some discussion of limitations or future directions. And typically, a news and views is going to be written by one of the scientists who was a reviewer for the paper. That's a little inside baseball. But then we also have a newer format called a research briefing, which is similar to a news and views in terms of providing that kind of rationale and some summary of the paper, and but it's actually written by the authors of the paper, and it has a little bit of extra content that's kind of fun too. So there's a little behind the paper blurb where they tell some of the stories, that went into the making of the research. There's a quote from one of the reviewers about why they thought it was cool, and there's a quote from one of the edit from the handling editor about why they thought it was cool. So that's kind of a fun thing to read too. But I think both of those content types are really nice, a nice way to kind of get up to speed with a paper and get oriented to a paper before you read it, especially when you're first starting out in neuroscience and there's kind of a lot of like jargon and background that might be hard to get oriented to. So that's always useful. Not every paper has that, but if a paper that you're interested in reading does, it's a nice idea to read that first. Yeah.
I 100% agree. Many of our classes actually at McGill encourage us to write news and views about articles that we read.
Oh,
And
fantastic.
there's assignments that we have to do on that. I did not know, however, that there were stories and parts that the reviewers found cool on the paper.
So that's it for a research briefing.
Yes.
That's a
Okay,
newer
there you go.
format that we've been doing for probably the last 3 or 4 years or something. But yeah, they're a lot of fun. They're a lot of fun to read. We got one recently. I had one where the behind the paper section, the authors were talking about how it was this big fMRI collaboration, and they were talking about how, it was so great. Like they worked across continents and people were working across, different time zones and whatever. And this person said, yeah, and for me, it was also a side job because I have a full-time day job. And I was like, oh my gosh, your full-time day job is not neuroscience? Okay. That's cool.
Incredible.
Interesting fact. Yeah.
Behind the paper, guys. So
Behind the
definitely
paper. Yeah.
something to look into. But what's interesting now is not only do you get to see what the reviewers found cool in behind the paper, but also Nature recently announced that that they'll publish peer review reports. So author responses, review. So you
Yes.
really.
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
Get a deeper inside look into this whole manuscript publishing review process.
Yes. And that's something that Nature Communications, another one of our sister journals, has been doing for a few years. And I think some version of that is likely to come to our journal and the other, what we call Nature Research journals, within the next few months also. I think it's great. I think probably most of the people who read the paper are not going to dig into reading all the reviewer reports, but for people who are really, really interested in a paper, I think it's a really nice way for people to understand the process and understand maybe the strengths and the weaknesses of the paper more.
Absolutely. Do you think that beyond transparent peer review, there are other mechanisms for this, I guess, ideal open science ecosystem that you guys are trying to bring?
Sure. Well, some of it we're already doing. So for example, preprint deposition, so putting your paper on like bioarchive usually around the time that you submit the paper to journals. That's something that we already encourage. And in fact, also our company has its own preprint server that you can also upload your papers onto if they're sent out. I think it's only if they're sent out for review. So, that's a great way to encourage openness and transparency and to kind of allow there to be discussion about the paper, prior to publication. Like I said, we do mandate that all the papers we publish have a code availability statement and a data availability statement. So that allows people to dig in more deeply to the research process. And we also do now have mechanisms for making code and data available to reviewers at the time of submission that are integrated into our submission platform. And we also offer open access publishing, which, so just stepping back, so the sort of traditional model for journals like ours is a subscription model. So the papers are only available to people who have a subscription. Usually it's a subscription through a university library. But since 2021, so since papers, I think, accepted in January 2021, we've offered the option for authors to choose to publish the paper open access, which means that anybody can access the paper freely, anywhere in the world, which is a really nice way of making the, we actually, the company has data that it actually does help improve the visibility of the paper. So the papers are cited more and they get more press coverage. But, importantly, it also helps improve, access to the science, especially a lot of the science that we publish is publicly funded. So it is nice to be able to make it publicly available. And, then it's accessible to high school students and people at smaller colleges and universities and citizen scientists and, all of that. So that's a really positive development also.
Absolutely. And it's one of the things I find the most exciting about like the whole open access and open science movement, especially because here in Quebec, for example, in Cégep, it's kind of between high school and your undergrad. We have 2 years or sometimes a bit more of Cégep. Not many of them are super geared to research. And so I remember being like going to my library and looking at the articles that were open access.
Oh,
It
that's
kind of got me,
fantastic.
introduced to a lot of the more research side of things instead of a more I guess application-based
Oh, how cool. I'm going to start using CJIP when I talk about open access publishing. That's great.
because Cégep is an in-between, right? So it's not necessarily, they don't also
They may not have
necessarily,
the subscriptions. Oh, that's a really good point.
they're the focus on them, but it really does depend on the Cégep as well. So anyways, it's a really fun, and it's also very personal for me. So that's one of the things I found really exciting. You looking ahead in the next maybe 5, 10 years, what gets your mind kind of racing and in a good way about where both neuroscience is headed, but also neuroscience publishing, the way you can share these discoveries? It's a big question, so
A big question. Where neuroscience is headed, I would say, I get really excited about the sort of trend towards increasing collaboration in neuroscience and being able to tackle big problems by working as a team. I think, we haven't even really scratched the surface of about scratched the surface of what AI is going to be able to bring us, both in terms of neuroscience discovery. And I would say maybe particularly developing new therapies and drugs, and also in terms of how AI is going to facilitate the publishing process and maybe improve the author experience and the reader experience. So I think it'll be really, really interesting to see how all of that develops. I mean, the field is moving very quickly. Honestly, every time I go to a conference, I come away and I think, oh wow. Oh wow, there's so much cause for optimism and there's so much cause for excitement. And that is truly one of the most beautiful and rewarding parts of having a career in science, because even when other aspects of the world may be depressing, science is just an inherently optimistic endeavor. So there's always something to be excited about. There's always something to be hopeful about. So tons of questions to be answered, and also a lot of room to really help people, who are suffering. And always exciting for me to come away and from, some kind of preclinical research and say, oh, that's going to be a really exciting direction, Within the field of neuroscience, in terms of trends, I mean, one trend that we've been seeing is this increasing thinking about relationships between the central nervous system and the rest of the body, and how does the brain sense what's going on in the immune system and various organ systems, and how is that regulated? We are moving beyond thinking about neuroscience topics or neuroscience related diseases as just being psychiatric diseases and neurodegenerative diseases, and we're starting to get papers that are neuroscience related but about like asthma or osteoporosis. There's so much neuroscience that we didn't even think of as neuroscience, that's an exciting direction. But yeah, I mean, I think, and it can be hard to predict because there can be these, like you mentioned, these sort of quantum leaps, these papers or these ideas that just like open up a whole new field, things like optogenetics or like CRISPR, right, where it's all of a sudden there's this whole new world of things that are possible. And that's hard to, those things are hard to predict, but always very exciting to witness and to be a part of.
So in such a fast-changing research environment, I was going to end this on a piece of advice, hopefully, that you would have for students who are inspired by your career. If you can give them a piece of advice on how they navigate their path in science.
I would say, or especially early in your career, at all times in your career, but I think especially when you're going to make the decisions that are going to start setting up your path. I would say really pay attention to how you feel. This may seem like obvious advice, but I think a lot of people don't do this. Pay attention to what are the tasks. What are the parts of what you're doing that make you feel excited? The things that you want to do more, things where you feel really good and really confident. And what are the things that make you feel anxious or that you want to put off or you want to do less of? Or they and so that could be thinking about, when you're doing lab rotations, what is your experience like with this lab? Like how do you feel when you're interacting with the PI? How do you feel when you're interacting with your other lab mates? I think sometimes as scientists especially, we have a tendency to sort of like discount our emotions or to feel like, we should just be practical and we shouldn't care about these things, and we should just go to whatever is like the best lab or whatever is, whoever's publishing the flashiest papers or whatever. You're going to be more successful and you're going to have a happier, more fulfilling life if you are in an environment that's positive for you. But even as you progress, maybe you've decided you've gone to a lab, you've decided to do a PhD, and now you're kind of trying to decide what you want to do next for your career. That could be another, that's another good time to sort of check in with yourself and say, do I love teaching? Do I love writing grants and writing papers? Do I love just being at the bench and doing things with my hands? And then the other thing I would say is think a lot about what you value and don't be ashamed or apologetic for valuing those things. Because I think also academia has this, can have, I think it's gotten better. They can have this culture of like the only worthwhile career is an academic career. And all you should care about is doing the best science that you can or publishing the best papers that you can. And you shouldn't care about things like having time for your hobbies or living close to your family or making money, right? Like those are lesser concerns, and you're not a serious person if you care about those things. And that's definitely what the culture was like when I was coming up, or even, it was kind of stigmatized to even like take vacations, or like maternity leave. And I think things have gotten a lot better, but I do think it's still important that you recognize your those values. Like I said, just make sure that you're moving in a direction that's going to help you optimize the things that you care about the most.
So listen to your values, listen to your emotions, and perhaps explore. You never know what
Oh,
opportunities
absolutely.
may present themselves. Like, for example, I didn't know like Nature Neuroscience, their editorial team, I believe, is currently is are you guys currently hiring?
We are hiring.
Oh,
Thank
like
you
there
for
are
mentioning that.
opportunities.
Yes, we are hiring. We are looking specifically for someone with cellular and molecular neuroscience experience. You can find the ad on our social media. You can find the ad at the Springer Nature Careers website. And feel free to apply and feel free to get in touch with me if you have any questions. You do have to have already completed your PhD, but yeah, we are hiring. We're happy for people to apply.
Opportunities are for those who look and follow the scent of their curiosity. So, with that, thank you so much, Sherry.
Oh, it was my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
This really delightful conversation.
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.